Ever wish you could, like, see the hidden pathways of information in a system?
Become a data detective.
Yeah, exactly. Or maybe, like, pinpoint a project's timeline, but with, like, almost scary accuracy.
That would be handy.
It's the kind of power business analysts tap into with these techniques we're diving into today.
We're talking data flow diagrams.
And a whole bunch of estimation tools.
Right.
Way beyond just, like, simple guesswork.
It's true. More than just fancy charts and graphs.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
Understanding them can seriously up your analyst game. You've shared your interest in these business analyst estimation techniques.
Always a hot topic.
So let's unpack these two articles from AdaptiveUS.com.
Great resources.
A Business Analyst's Guide to Data Flow Diagrams, or DFDs. And then, very appropriately, the Business Analyst Estimation Techniques Guide. Ready to go from, like, big picture thinking to surprisingly specific examples.
Absolutely. By the end of this deep dive, much clearer picture of how these techniques can help make those big project decisions.
Okay, let's demystify these data flow diagrams, DFDs for short.
Everyone loves a good acronym.
Imagine you're looking at a systems blueprint.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
But instead of walls and wiring, you're seeing how data flows through it, like mapping out a river, showing where the information flows, where it's stored, who interacts with it along the way. What do you think is the most crucial part of understanding that flow?
It's all about pinpointing those bottlenecks.
Bottlenecks.
Yeah, those areas where the flow gets disrupted or slowed down, just like a clogged pipe, right? Causes problems in a plumbing system. A bottleneck in that data flow can disrupt an entire business process.
So it's not just about creating a, like, a pretty picture.
No, those are nice too.
It's about understanding the system's efficiency, right?
Mm-hmm.
How does that help someone in a real world situation, like, say, during a presentation?
Think about it. Have you ever tried to explain a complex process to someone who's not familiar with all the technical jargon?
Oh, all the time.
DFD can be a lifesaver. Instead of drowning them in details, you visually represent that flow of information.
Makes it easier to grasp.
Exactly. Even for those who aren't, you know, tech savvy.
It's like that saying, a picture's worth 1,000 words.
Or 1,000 lines of code in this case.
Okay, I'm sold on their usefulness. But, gotta ask about those shapes and arrows.
Can't forget those.
Always popping up in DFDs. What do they really mean?
It can seem like its own language.
It really does.
Let's decode it. The most crucial symbol for beginners, the rectangle. Think of it as the action symbol, the verb in a sentence.
Okay.
Represents the process being performed on the data.
So, like, if you're mapping out an online order.
Perfect example.
The rectangle might be that process order action.
Exactly.
Got it. So that rectangle is the doing part of the data's little journey.
Yeah.
What about the data itself? How's that shown moving around?
Ah, that's where those arrows come in. But not just any arrows. These are labeled. They're directional, showing the exact path of the data as it cruises through the system.
Like a roadmap.
Exactly. You can trace that data's journey from its origin to its destination, like following a breadcrumb trail.
Makes sense. Now, I did notice some other shapes in the articles, like squares, open-ended rectangles.
Mm.
What are those representing on our data roadmap?
Good eye. So squares, sometimes you see them as rounded rectangles too, represent those external entities interacting with the system.
External entities, so like?
Users, other software systems, basically anything outside the main process but still involved.
Got it.
The open-ended rectangles you mentioned, those are your data stores.
Data stores, I'll say.
Think databases, spreadsheets, anywhere that information is held.
Okay, this is starting to feel less like an abstract concept and more like something you'd actually use, you know, on the job.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fascinating to think that this all started with, like, hand-drawn flowcharts back in the 1970s.
Mm. Long before today's fancy software.
I know. And just like anything in tech, it's evolved like crazy. Today we've got software like Microsoft Visio, Lucidchart.not. Makes creating and managing these DFDs so much easier.
It's incredible how far we've come.
Right. Like, is the difference between writing a novel by hand versus using a word processor? Speaking of progress, the article mentioned different zoom levels for DFDs. Is that like choosing between a map of the entire country or a detailed street view?
Perfect analogy. You can have a high-level DFD that gives that bird's-eye view of the whole system, Or you can zoom into a specific process and map out every little detail.
Depends on what you need to see.
Right. Depends on the level of granularity for the task at hand.
So not a one-size-fits-all solution. You tailor it to the project.
Exactly.
I like it. And speaking of tailoring solutions, the article highlighted how these DFDs can help pinpoint those bottlenecks we talked about.
Yeah, they're great for that.
Can you give me a real-world example of how a DFD might reveal a bottleneck?
Sure. Let's say you're analyzing the customer onboarding process for a new software platform.
Okay.
You create your DFD and realize there's this, like, massive delay in getting new customer data from the sales team to the customer support team.
Oh, no. That's never good.
No. And this delay, it leads to a poor onboarding experience because customers are left waiting for support. But by identifying this bottleneck through the DFD,
you can fix it.
You can streamline that data flow, maybe automate the transfer of information and significantly improve the customer experience, could even lead to increased customer retention, you know, positive reviews.
Wow, that's huge. By just like visually mapping out the process, you uncover this hidden bottleneck that would have been tough to spot otherwise. And the impact, improving the customer experience, potentially boosting retention, all thanks to a DFD. Okay, I'm really starting to see how powerful this tool can be, but are there any downsides? Are there situations where they might not be the best fit?
You bring up a good point. While DFDs are excellent for visualizing how that data moves through the system, they don't always capture the when of that movement.
The timing.
Yeah, if understanding the timing or sequence of events is super critical to your analysis, you might need to supplement your DFD with other diagrams or techniques.
So if I'm mapping out a manufacturing process where the order of operations is absolutely crucial, a DFD alone might not cut it. But it could still be valuable for understanding that overall flow of materials and information.
Precisely. DFDs are a powerful tool in a business analyst's arsenal, but like any tool, they have their limitations.
Right. They're not magic.
The key is understanding those limitations and using them strategically alongside other techniques to get that comprehensive understanding of the system you're analyzing.
Okay. That's a crucial takeaway. Now, the article also mentioned something called Unified Modeling Language, or UML. How does that compare to a DFD?
It's easy to get them confused.
I bet.
UML is like this bigger umbrella encompassing a whole family of diagrams used for software development, system modeling.
Mm-hmm.
DFDs are just one type of diagram within that larger UML family. They specifically focus on data flow, while other UML diagrams might represent system architecture, object interactions, or even user behavior.
So if UML is the whole toolbox, a DFD is like the trusty screwdriver.
I like that. Essential, but not the only tool you'll need.
Exactly. Speaking of essential tools, if someone wants to try creating their own DFD, what are the key steps involved?
It's actually less intimidating than it sounds.
Really?
Oh, yeah. First, you define your system boundaries. What are you actually trying to map out? Then identify those external entities we discussed, list out those main system processes, the data stores, and finally connect everything with those labeled arrows to show that data flow.
This sounds pretty straightforward.
And importantly, keep it simple, easy to understand, even for someone who's never seen a DFD before.
You're making me want to grab my digital whiteboard and just start mapping out every process I can think of.
Go for it.
But I have a feeling we'll get to flex those DFD muscles a bit later.
Indeed, we will. And before we move on, one more point I want to emphasize. Remember that GRC management system from the article? Let's use its project schedule management module as a practical example.
Perfect. I'm ready to see DFDs in action.
Mm.
Where do we even begin with something like that? The article mentioned external entities first.
Right. In this case, you'd start by identifying who's feeding information into this system.
Okay, so.
So you've got users searching for schedules, and then there's likely a project manager adding new schedules, updating existing ones, or maybe even deleting a few.
So those are our external entities.
Okay.
They're outside the system itself, but actively interacting with it through those actions.
Exactly. And each of those actions would then trigger a specific process within the system.
Am I on the right track?
You are spot on. For example, a user searching for a specific project schedule might interact with a search schedule process. This process would then access the schedule data store, retrieve the relevant information, and deliver it back to the user.
So we've got our external entities, our processes, and our data stores all connected through those labeled arrows, illustrating the flow of information. It's like watching the system come to life. But enough about DFDs for now. I'm dying to unpack those estimation techniques. After all, that's a big part of what makes a business analyst so valuable, isn't it?
Absolutely. And just like with DFDs, there's a lot more to estimation than meets the eye. It's about moving beyond gut feeling and using data-driven techniques to make informed predictions about project timelines, budgets, and resources.
And that's where those estimation techniques come in. So let's dive into those. What's the biggest misconception people have about estimation?
Most people think it's just about throwing out a random number and hoping for the best. But in reality, it's a structured discipline that's evolved significantly over time.
It's about moving from gut feeling to data-driven projections.
Precisely. And just like with DFDs, there are different types of estimation techniques, each with its strengths and weaknesses.
Okay, you've piqued my curiosity.
Yeah.
What are some of the most common estimation techniques in a business analyst's arsenal? So many techniques. It's like having this whole utility belt of like estimation tools. Let's start with one you mentioned, rough order of magnitude. ROM almost sounds like casual.
Yeah.
When would you actually pull that one out?
You're right. It does have that like back of the napkin feel, and that's exactly when it's useful. Early on in a project, haven't gotten into the detailed requirements yet. You just need a general idea, you know, the scope, timeline, budget.
So if a client comes to you with like this vague idea and wants to know if it's even doable, ROM can help you give them a quick ballpark figure without getting bogged down in the weeds.
Exactly. It's about setting realistic expectations from the get-go. And for that, you've got techniques like top-down and bottom-up estimation, which are all about kind of like dissecting the project into smaller, more manageable pieces.
Makes sense. Breaking down a complex problem into bite-sized chunks. I'm sensing a theme here. It's all about finding ways to like wrangle complexity into something more digestible. How do top-down and bottom-up differ in their approaches?
Imagine you have this beautifully decorated cake. Top-down is like estimating the cake's total cost based on its size, ingredients, complexity, while bottom-up is like adding up the cost of each individual slice.
Okay, I'm with you.
With top-down, you start with the big picture, the overall project budget, and allocate that budget across different project components.
So you're starting with a big vision and then dividing the pie, so to speak, amongst the different parts of the project. What about bottom-up? Sounds like you're starting with the pieces and working your way up.
That's the gist. You break the project down into its tiniest tasks and estimate the effort required for each. Then you add up those individual estimates to arrive at the total project estimate.
It sounds incredibly accurate, but also pretty time-consuming, especially for like larger, more complex projects.
Mm.
Are there situations where one approach might be more suitable than the other?
Absolutely. If you need a quick, high-level estimate, top-down is your go-to. But if you've got the time and need that really precise figure, bottom-up might be worth the extra effort.
It's about choosing the right tool for the job, as always. Speaking of specialized tools, you mentioned a technique called parametric estimation.
Mm.
What makes that one stand out?
Parametric estimation, that's where things get really interesting. It leverages the power of historical data, mathematical formulas to actually predict future outcomes. It's like having a crystal ball, but one that's grounded in data and statistical analysis.
Okay, that sounds both intriguing and a little intimidating. Can you give me a real-world example of how that might work?
Let's say you're estimating the time it takes to develop software features. With parametric estimation, you'd analyze data from past projects, how long it took to develop similar features. Were there any factors that like significantly impacted those timelines? By inputting this data into, you know, specialized software, you can then generate more data-driven estimates for your current project.
So you're essentially using the past to predict the future. But isn't there a risk in relying too heavily on historical data? What if this current project have like unique challenges that weren't present in those past projects?
That's a great point. It highlights why parametric estimation shouldn't be used in isolation. It's crucial to consider the unique context of each project and adjust your estimations accordingly. This is where the art of estimation comes in, combining data-driven techniques with your own experience, intuition, understanding of the project's nuances.
It sounds like a delicate dance between data and intuition, relying on both to navigate those uncertainties of project estimation. And speaking of uncertainty, how do you estimate for the unknown? Projects, they rarely go exactly according to plan, so how do you build in that, like, that wiggle room for the unexpected?
That's where a technique like rolling wave estimation comes in handy. It embraces the fact that plans change, encourages you to adjust your estimations as the project unfolds.
So instead of trying to predict the entire project timeline up front, you're breaking it down into smaller phases and estimating each phase as you go. Like, navigating a winding road, you can't see every curve and bend ahead of time, but you adjust your course as you go.
Precisely. You start with a high-level estimate for the whole project, but you only estimate the first phase in detail. Then, as you complete each phase, you gain more information, which allows you to refine those estimates for the subsequent phases.
It's a more, like, agile and adaptable approach to estimation. Makes a lot of sense in today's fast-paced world where project requirements can change at the drop of a hat. But let's talk about another challenge, bias. We all have our biases, whether we're aware of them or not, and those biases can, like, creep into our estimations, sometimes without us even realizing it.
Bias is a very real concern in estimation, can lead to inaccurate predictions, ultimately unsuccessful projects. That's why techniques like the Delphi technique are so valuable. This method is designed to mitigate that individual bias by gathering anonymous estimates from multiple experts.
So instead of relying on a single person's perspective, which could be, like, skewed by their own experiences and biases, you're tapping into the collective wisdom of a group while ensuring anonymity to encourage honest and unbiased feedback.
Exactly. This anonymity allows experts to share their estimates without fear of judgment or pressure to, you know, to conform to a particular viewpoint.
Sounds like a powerful way to, like, reduce bias and tap into a more diverse range of perspectives.
Yeah.
But even with the best techniques and a team of experts, there's always a chance things won't go, you know, exactly according to plan. So how do you balance the desire for accuracy with the reality that estimation is not, like, an exact science?
That's where understanding the difference between, like, accuracy and precision becomes crucial. Imagine you're practicing archery. Accuracy is about hitting the bullseye, while precision is about hitting the same spot consistently, even if it's not the bullseye.
So you can have a very precise estimate that's consistently off target. That wouldn't be very helpful.
Exactly. It's about finding that sweet spot where your estimations are both accurate, close to the actual outcome, and precise, consistently reliable over time.
And how do we achieve that balance between accuracy and precision? What steps can we take to ensure our estimations are not just close, but consistently close?
Consistency is key. The more consistently you apply your chosen estimation techniques, gather that data, and document your assumptions, the more precise your estimations will become over time. It's also crucial to, like, cross-validate your estimations using multiple techniques.
So don't just rely on one method. Try using a combination of, like, top-down, bottom-up, parametric, or any other techniques that seem appropriate for the project.
Exactly. Think of it like using multiple tools to get a clearer picture.
It's about being thorough, using all the tools at your disposal, always striving to, like, refine your approach. Now, we've talked a lot about techniques, but what about the people involved in this whole estimation process? Who are those key contributors, and why are they so important?
Accurate estimation is a team effort. It starts with historical data from past projects. This is a gold mine of information. Then you've got your subject matter experts, the folks with that deep knowledge in specific areas. They can provide invaluable insights into the complexities of different tasks, potential roadblocks, you know, things to watch out for.
So if you're, like, estimating a software development project, you'd want to talk to your developers, your testers, your designers to get their input on the, like, the technical nitty-gritty of the project.
Exactly. It's about tapping into their expertise to make more informed estimations.
Who else should be involved in this collaborative estimation party?
Don't forget about your stakeholders. These are the people who have a vested interest in the project's success, so their input is crucial.
This might include, like, project sponsors, business users, even end users, right?
Yeah.
It's about making sure everyone's voice is heard. Their needs and constraints are considered during that estimation process.
Precisely. And don't underestimate the value of industry benchmarks and standards. These can provide valuable context and help you ensure your estimations are in line with what's considered reasonable within your industry or domain.
So it's like we're, like, benchmarking against the collective wisdom of our industry, making sure our estimations aren't totally out there, right? It's like checking the price of fish at different markets before you buy, just to make sure you're getting a fair deal.
That's a great analogy. It's all about gathering as much info as possible to make those smart choices.
Speaking of smart choices, let's shift gears for a sec and talk about the benefits of really mastering these estimation techniques.
Mm-hmm.
What are the rewards for those who put in the time to become, like, estimation gurus?
Oh, their rewards are huge. Improved decision making is probably the most immediate benefit. Accurate estimations give you the insights you need to confidently make those critical choices. Project scope, timelines, budgets, the whole nine yards.
It's like having a roadmap. Instead of just, like, wandering around in the dark hoping for the best, right?
Exactly. You can navigate those tricky project paths with way more confidence and, honestly, clarity. And that confidence, it extends to your communication with stakeholders, too.
Oh, that's huge.
Right. Clear, realistic estimations, they make it so much easier to manage those expectations, keep everyone on the same page, and avoid those dreaded scope creep conversations or budget blowouts.
Transparency from the start. I like it. It's about building trust, accountability.
Absolutely. And here's another benefit that I think often gets overlooked, risk reduction.
Okay.
By accurately estimating projects, you can proactively identify potential risks early on, assess their impact, and actually develop those contingency plans before those risks turn into major, major problems.
It's like that saying, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. But in this case, it's an accurate estimate that could save you countless headaches down the line.
And probably some budget, too.
Oh, for sure.
And we can't forget about resource allocation. Accurate estimations help you figure out those optimal resources, right? The right people, the right tools, the right budget to actually successfully deliver your projects.
Working smarter, not harder.
Exactly. It's about making the absolute most of your resources, maximizing your team's potential. And, you know, all of these benefits, they compound over time. The more you practice these techniques, the better you become at estimation, and the more value you bring to the team and the organization as a whole.
It's a beautiful cycle of, like, estimation excellence.
Yeah.
But let's address the elephant in the room. Let's talk about these common misconceptions that often surround estimation.
Yes. Because despite our best efforts, there are definitely still some myths floating around that we need to, like, bust wide open.
Let's do it.
One of the biggest ones I hear all the time, estimation is an exact science.
Right. People crave certainty, especially when you're talking about project timelines and budgets. But the reality is,
it's messy. Estimation is as much an art as it is a science.
I like that.
You're using data, experience, professional judgment to make, you know, educated predictions about the future. But the future, by its very nature, is uncertain.
So true. So we need to approach estimation with a little bit of humility and be ready to adapt as the project, you know, does its thing. What other misconceptions do we often encounter out there?
Another common one is that estimation is this one-time activity, something you do at the very beginning of a project and then never touch again.
Oh, I wish that were true.
Right.
But we know estimation is ongoing, something to be revisited and, like, refined throughout the entire project life cycle.
Exactly. As you gather more information, encounter those unexpected challenges, or even just learn more about the project itself, your estimations should evolve too. It's not about being right or wrong at that initial stage. It's about being responsive and making those adjustments as needed.
It's a journey, not a destination.
Well said.
Okay, so another misconception I've heard is that estimation is solely the responsibility of the business analyst.
Ah, yes. The myth of the lone wolf estimator.
Exactly. Riding off into the sunset with their spreadsheet. But we know that estimation is a team sport, right?
Absolutely. It's about collaborating with stakeholders, subject matter experts, the development team, anyone who can provide those valuable insights, those different perspectives.
So instead of shouldering that whole burden alone, it's about creating an environment where everyone feels comfy contributing their knowledge and experience to the estimation process.
100%.
Okay, last myth I want to tackle estimation is a waste of time.
Yeah, that's a classic.
Why bother with estimations when those project requirements are constantly in flux? But even if estimations aren't always spot on, the process itself is incredibly valuable, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. The value is in the conversations it starts, the assumptions it challenges, those aha moments.
It's about creating that shared understanding of what the project actually entails, its scope, complexity, and yet potential challenges, which is, like, essential for effective planning and decision making.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
Okay, so we've busted some myths, hopefully shed some light on the benefits of really mastering this crucial skill. What practical advice would you give to someone who's just starting out in business analysis and wants to make estimation a core part of their process?
I'd say, first and foremost, embrace the data. Data-driven estimations are where it's at. Gather all that historical data you can from past projects.
It's like having a treasure map.
Exactly. Analyze those projects, identify trends, look for patterns that might inform your current estimations, and don't be afraid to reach out to those subject matter experts. You don't have to be the smartest person in the room to be a great estimator.
So if you're estimating a marketing campaign, for example, talk to your marketing team. Pick their brains about what's worked well in the past, what hasn't, and what factors they think might influence the success of this new campaign.
Precisely. Their insights are so valuable, and it shows that you value their expertise, which goes a long way in building that trust and collaboration. And here's another tip. Break those complex tasks down into smaller, more manageable chunks. It's way easier to estimate a smaller, well-defined task than some large, ambiguous chunk of work.
Divide and conquer. It's a classic strategy for a reason.
Exactly. And once you've estimated those smaller tasks, then you can aggregate them to get that more accurate picture of the overall effort.
So break it down, conquer those estimates, and build it back up.
You got it. And here's another crucial tip. Don't underestimate documentation. Be sure to clearly document all the assumptions you're making during that estimation process. This creates a super valuable audit trail and helps you explain any adjustments or revisions to your estimations as the project moves along.
Transparency.
Exactly. And don't limit yourself to just one estimation technique. Explore all those different methods we discussed, experiment with them, discover which ones work best for you in different situations.
Have your toolbox ready.
Right. And remember, estimation is iterative. Your initial estimations are rarely going to be perfect, and that's okay. The key is to embrace that iterative nature, be open to feedback, you know, learn from those little missteps, and continuously refine your approach.
So it's all about being flexible, adaptable, always learning.
You got it.
This has been an awesome deep dive.
I agree.
We've explored those data flow diagrams, demystified a whole bunch of estimation techniques, and even tackled that human side of estimation. From biases to the power of collaboration, it's all connected.
It really is.
So any final words of wisdom for our listeners who are ready to take their estimation skills to the next level?
Embrace the challenge. Estimation is a crucial skill. It can truly make or break a project. So be curious, be creative, and never, ever stop learning.
Beautifully said. And remember, estimation, it's a journey, not a destination. There's always more to learn, new techniques to try out, and ways to refine your craft.
I couldn't agree more.
And on that note, it's time for us to sign off. But fear not, estimation enthusiasts will be back next time with another deep dive into this ever-evolving world of business analysis. Until then, happy estimating.